Welcome to Inspiring Stories for Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Hello, my name is Tim McMillan. Welcome to another episode of Inspiring Stories brought to you by Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. My guest in this episode is a man of many talents and many, many accomplishments. A champion footballer, he wore the jerseys of various clubs around Australia, also the Socceroos, and in England with Crystal Palace and Portsmouth. The end of his professional days saw him move into the commentary box, where he was fortunate enough to sit alongside absolute legends of the game, like Johnny Warren and Les Murray. More recently, he's become a human rights activist and author, spearheading an incredible and difficult campaign to save Melbourne-based former Bahraini footballer turned refugee Hakeem Al-Arabi, who'd been arrested in Thailand at the command of Bahraini authorities. They wanted him back in the Gulf state to face what was almost certainly going to be a life of persecution. It is an incredible story in itself. Craig Foster, hello. Thank you for your time.
Oh, that's my pleasure, Tim. Nice to speak with you.
We're going to spend some time going through that extraordinary tale in a little while of Hakeem. But firstly, let's talk about you. Craig Andrew Foster, a name that doesn't end in a vowel. It doesn't end in itch or ski. Growing up in Australia, you wanted to play football. How did that come about?
Well, I'm from up in a country area of New South Wales. Many people in Australia, and I'm sure in WA as well, will know, whilst you have your very beautiful holiday spots, we have up in northern New South Wales some of the best, I would argue. Byron Bay.
Controversial.
And they're hard to beat, and that's where I'm from. I'm from a place called Lismore, just inland to those to that area. So extraordinarily beautiful, natural environment. And when I was growing up, a very Anglo environment as well. There's a diversity, cultural diversity that we do happily have up in that area today, which is wonderful. A very high, or higher than the national average, Indigenous, Aboriginal population in particular, but as for other cultural backgrounds, very few and far between it was as I was growing up. And so the, a life spent in football has been a great gift for me because I've been able to spend my entire life from the age of probably 15, I'm 52 now, within multicultures. That is both multicultural Australia and various cultures around the world by traveling and playing the beautiful game of football. Growing up in the country, sport in Australia in many areas has always been really important. It's a central part of community. So all us country kids played virtually every sport. Became skilled at a few. Usually you had a lot of multi-sport athletes come out of those types of areas. And I just at some point decided that football was the one. You know, I used to watch English Premier League or English First Division as it was on a Monday night.
Yeah.
It's called Match of the Day.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have it.
Yet, that was so all you had, actually, right? That was all there was.
We didn't even have the SBS signal. We used to call it Channel 28. So yeah. It was ironic. I ended up on SBS. I didn't even know what it was. And then, used to watch Tottenham and Liverpool and Craigie Johnston and, you know, legends like that and think that would be wonderful one day. And then, you know, it just kind of went on from there.
To fall in love with the round ball, though, when there were so many other sports around and you would have seen so much attention poured on, I'm guessing, NRL. In that part of New South Wales, what was it that made you fall in love with the round ball above all others?
I didn't play a lot of rugby league, very little. I mean, they just used to smash the hell out of me, you know, so it wasn't the most enjoyable. My brother played a bit and my friends played, but I just found an aptitude for the game. And I used to play a lot of basketball, cricket. Actually, one of your guys over there I was speaking to the other day, Adam Gilchrist, went to our school.
He
and his brothers.
So, same school.
Yeah, so they were same school, They come in high school, to Cadena High School in Ganellabar in Lismore. And so we all played cricket and football, soccer together, in both the teams. And they were better cricketers and we probably had a bit more aptitude for football. So we all kind of found our right place in the end, which was nice. I'm not sure how Gilly would have went, you know, as a number 10 for the Socceroos, but
he would have made a fantastic goalie too, actually, wouldn't he?
He probably would have. You're right, actually. You're right. So we all love the sport. It's what brought the community together. And, you know, a life in sport, as you would know, whether it's playing it or discussing it and so on, is really lovely.
Yep.
I think the older I get, I have a lot of gratitude for what a sport has been able to provide for me. And therefore, I try to use what I have to give other children the same opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And that means having not just access to sport, but also to lower barriers of racism and other things that they might face. But yeah, I made that choice for football, and then I went down in my mid-teens. You know, I played for the Australian junior team and ended up at the AIS in their program, and from there it was just a stepping stone to moving on Socceroos and others.
At what point did you realise that you were actually pretty good at this? You mentioned playing for Australia there as a teenager. Under 16s, yeah, you went to the World Champs in China. You guys made the quarterfinals. At what point did someone tell you, or did you work out for yourself, that you're actually pretty darn good at this sport?
Well, you know, I started to progress and make the representative teams. But I was never kind of, you know, I didn't make those teams as a young person and think, oh, wow, you know, I'm doing really great. I must be really good. You just kind of, you know, the thing about sport is it's about progress. It's about ambition. You know, it's about, you know, the next achievement. And, you know, so it teaches all of those things as you go. I don't know how much, you know, some of us might have those things inherently.
Yep.
Or whether we learned those skills through sport in early times, because, you know, we still continue to apply all those things today, always looking for the next challenge, you know. You know, you just start to make these various representative teams, you know, under 12s, under 13s, under 14s, and it just kind of snowballs, and people give you the positive feedback around as well. And as I've said many times also, the older I get, I recognise that there was no barriers in front of me either.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
You know, here I am. I'm a white Anglo young player out of a very white, beautiful country town. And so no one ever looked at me askance. No one ever thought, you know, I had no problem with the language. You know, I'm in the predominance of the cultural majority. And so I was able to just go really, aside from injury, really quite smoothly through and be able to just create a career.
Having said all that, given your attributes and your background, how did you go being welcomed into the fold at Sydney, Croatia, where you played in some of your early days? We're talking the late 80s, back in the NSL era of Australian football, where you had clubs that were so entrenched in their communities and took on, you know, the religion and the ethnicity of that community, you know, to a great degree. How did you go fitting into that environment as still a kid?
Yeah, just a kid. Yeah, really wonderful time. It was very new for me because, as I said, I hadn't watched it on TV. I hadn't grown up with all of these clubs, even in the immediately preceding years. So I went to the AIS, and all of the kids who were there with us, a lot from Victoria and from Sydney and from capital cities, and they knew about SBS. They knew Les and Johnny. They knew all of these clubs, and their ambition was to play for them. Whereas I didn't really have a clue what was going on. I just thought, you know, I'd like to go and play for the country. That was my ambition, coming out of a country that's typically very important to us. And, you know, when I used to sit with my family and my father and my grandfather and his brothers and all of our aunties and so on, you know, very regularly we would get together, very family-oriented atmosphere. They would watch cricket all day long. You know, in fact, they would watch all of the tests, you know, and the Christmas tests and the Boxing Day tests and all of these things. And so it was very much revered, you know, and people who did that, you know, Ian Chappell and Alan Border and, you know, and they would talk endlessly about these people, and it was just a really central part of their life. But there was a sense to me very clearly that they felt a real, not just adulation, but, you know, a deep respect for these people who played the sport that they played and loved, but played at a different level, but also were able to carry this responsibility of not just playing for Australia, but in their view, acting in a way that they thought was Australian. That was very important to them.
Yep.
Ian Chappell is doing this, and that's fine with us because of this, you know, and so, you know, that kind of became, I guess, part of my DNA. So pulling on the green and gold was always very important. But looking back, you know, one of the great gifts that football has, of course, is our diversity, but also one of the real gifts that it gave the country, and I sit on the Australian Multicultural Council today, of course, is I recognise now we all recognise, all sports, the importance of new arrivals from all different backgrounds, cultural, religious and other, coming to Australia and finding their way into society, right? Mm. And being able to what we call, you know, integrate. That is, just become part of the country and make your own way, whatever that is. And sport is, of course, in this country, a huge connecting factor, you know, a really critically important factor. And I was just out yesterday, you know, giving some footballs and boots to some of our new Afghan families, for example, who've only been here for a number of weeks. And the first thing that the kids want is, you know, football to be able to go outside and play. You know, they've got 30 of them doing it with one ball. So it just shows you the importance.
Yep.
Football was that to many migrant communities. And then it allowed me, therefore, it allowed all of these communities to not only integrate in Australian society, but work out their own enmities between them. And it also gave me a platform then to step into that environment and start to understand the different cultures. And that's been a beautiful part of my life.
Yeah, and continues to be, more and more so by the sounds of it. Foz, we need to take a quick break. After that, I want to ask you about the moment you were asked to take on the green and gold, wear the green and gold for the first time as a Socceroo. We'll get into that right after we take a break. Craig Foster is our special guest. This is Inspiring Stories. Back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Our special guest in this episode is Craig Foster. Craig, 29 caps for the Socceroos. 9 goals you put in the back of the net with the green and gold on. Tell me about the first time you were invited to be a part of the team. That must have been an incredibly special moment for you.
It was pretty special because it took me until I was 26 years old. And whilst I came up very young and by the age of 15, almost 16, I was playing in the young team in the world, in the first Kids World Cup, basically. You know, and that whole generation, therefore, was seen as, you know, a group of stars coming through, and we had some fabulous players there. I got some really bad injuries, and it took me many, many, many years to battle back. And I just kept going and going and going and going. And, you know, I broke the bone in my foot 3 times, which as a footballer, of course, is not terribly helpful. So I ended up with screws in my I had screws in my ankle, screws in my foot. You know, I had reconstructions on my knees. In fact, my second reconstruction, I was still in the Socceroos, and this goes to show late 90s. This goes to show you how the difference in sports science works today. And we actually had a game we were playing against the FIFA World 11. It was here in Sydney. It was one of the games, or might have been the game to open the ANZ today's ANZ Stadium, Australia Stadium.
Yeah.
And I was at, I think it was at Chris's Palace at the time, still in the Socceroos, and I just said to the coaching staff and others, look, I can't play in the game, you know, because I've got my hamstring's gone. I've got a bad hamstring. And they said, oh, okay, no worries, we'll just come back. So I went out to the game, you know, with a pair of tracksuit pants on and just hung around, you know, saying, look, you know, it's just not good. Whereas, in fact, I'd had a reconstruction of the knee. You know, that was the old, you know, that was the 80s and the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, it was nothing like today. Now, if we had have had, you know, the sports science support that players have today, you know, very likely we wouldn't have had those operations. But
yeah,
so I had to battle through, to answer your question. And yeah. I ended up being selected. We went over to South Africa and I played the first game against Ghana. So, look, I remember it very well. Everyone does. You know, we change over time though, but I always thought playing for Australia was something very important. It represented to me, you know, it was a portion. I couldn't say what portion, but it was a portion to do with being an athlete and representing and actually competing and reaching what I saw as, you know, one of the highest levels.
Mm.
But it was very much a very large portion to me about this notion of what it meant to me to be Australian. You know, yep. I really felt that strongly. Of course, at 52, my notion of that is very different to what it was when I was 26. But I was already at that time, for instance, a member of the Republican movement. And even at that time, I was speaking with Malcolm Turnbull around the, a couple of years later on the referendum and these types of things. So, you know,
yep.
I remember how I felt on the day, and now today I look back and think, well, you know what? The truth is that, you know, I'd like to see our flag changed. You know, I'd like to see our anthem change, become more representative. And we had one word recently. I think we should do more and recognize our ancient history and all of these things.
Mm.
You know, that's how I reflect on, you know, sport to me now is just the prism for everything, right? And so even when I think about those sporting moments, I always see it through this kind of context of, you know, where I am today in my 50s and where Australia is.
Yeah. Having said that, just on the sporting level alone, being part of the Socceroos at that time, we were so desperate to have another crack at a World Cup, weren't we? And unfortunately, you were in the team during a period where we didn't quite make it. I mean, certainly you were there in the commentary box when we did make it to qualify for 2006. But did you feel an enormous weight of pressure? And the country was just riding the wave of hope so hard, weren't they? I mean, 98 to Iran, 94 to Argentina, 2002 to Uruguay. Playing at least through the Iran time. What was that like, carrying that weight of expectation?
Yeah, it was 97. So, you know, we were there in 74. So you're talking, you know, 23 years. There was huge expectation. The game was, you know, close to bankrupt, and therefore this team had, you know, could deliver several million dollars in prize money. So, of course, we knew the broader context. You had Les and Johnny on air, you know, talking about it, and we understood. But the thing about as an athlete is that you become very skilled at blocking out those things. And you become that's what I see as this concept of professionalism. You know, professionalism from the athlete side is really the ability to, of course, work on your craft and your profession, your trade every day, you know, in a systematic manner and improve. But more than that, in sport, it's about being able to perform under any type of pressure.
Yep.
And so, you know, all I remember about that game is the game.
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember the crowd. I don't remember the thing. I just remember the fact that, you know, we pretty much smashed Iran, you know, and then this guy came and jumped on the net. There was no way, no one would ever say there's no way we weren't going to win that game. You know, Iran were really beaten in a lot of respects. They had no answers. They couldn't readjust. Their best players weren't performing. There wasn't that much longer to go in the game. And there was, you know, and we were in almost complete dominance. And then someone, this person jumped on the net, stopped the game. They were able to readjust. We clearly didn't readjust well enough. And the, you know, their coach, I think, did some good work. They came out, they were different. They got a reward quickly, and the game changed very, very quickly. And all I remember afterwards is just the devastation of the fact, because we knew you do. I think afterwards, you know, that's when the emotion comes out, because you allow yourself to realize that, you know, all different levels, the family, friends, the game, you know, what it would have meant for football in Australia, the country, people who, you know, love the national team, you do then get a sense that, oh, man, you know, this is really, really bad.
And I still remember it so well. It was terrible.
It was horrible. And it was just like, you know, it's probably inappropriate analogy at the moment, but it was just like, I was going to say it was like death, you know, it was like someone had actually passed away, because no one could talk. Everyone just sat, and you couldn't. And it actually was difficult, because in the month after that, I remember going back abroad, and you actually couldn't talk to anyone about what had gone on, because people outside of that team couldn't possibly understand. You know, it's an odd feeling that, you know, it was only when we came together a month later, we went to play in the Confederations Cup, that actually some of the players, I think including me on the flight, were in tears, because we just hadn't been able to process what had happened, because how are you going to talk to it about?
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah. You could have talked to me, Craig. I would have understood. Was it some consolation then for you, where you're trying to process that you move from Australia over to England to take up a spot at Portsmouth with Terry Venables? On a personal level, that must have been a huge sense of achievement, though, getting invited to go and play in England.
Well, yes. But, you know, again, you don't, I don't think during a sporting career, you never, you know, you don't take the time to kind of acknowledge milestones. You're just always looking ahead at, you know, and everything's a new challenge.
Yep.
And that was a new challenge. And I went there, you know, in the second part of my 20s. And, you know, and I went into an environment that was very different. And so, you know, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. Crowds, amazing, very, very different. You know, and of course, the weather and the environment, you know, very challenging for playing. It's not like today where they have all the pitches are all underheated and all yeah. these things. It was kind of, but you know, I had grown up with England being, you know, the only really global football that we watched, and yep. so yeah, it was nice.
Yeah, Fratton Park, not what it is today. Is it? You get a bit boggy down there on the coast.
Well, yeah, I mean, but those fans, the Pompey yeah. fans, are just really yeah. extraordinary. But again, yeah. incredible. You know, I was also there in an era which financially was really difficult for the clubs. It was at the time when a lot of them were falling over. You know, and so many clubs were going into administration. And so, you know, that's what ended up happening with Portsmouth. So I saw the good and bad of the game. I saw the love of the fans. I saw the beauty of the culture and so on. But I also saw the financial mismanagement. I saw the impact of that on fans. I saw fans trying to buy their own clubs back. You know, mm-hmm. I saw players out of work and all of those things. And so all of those were good learnings mm. for what I do today, you know, in terms of broadcasting and speaking about broad sport, not just football.
Yeah. Coming back to Australia, I know you had a stint at Crystal Palace as well. We have to sort of zip through your resume here a bit, Craig. Coming back to Australia, you know, you finished your professional playing days here in Australia. You mentioned some of the injuries you had before. How is the body now? Is it holding up okay, or are you still, you know, having to nurse aches and pains from those days?
Well, I'm okay because I have a policy, I try to do as little exercise as possible. And therefore, you know, I'm not one running out and going to gyms and all these things. So, yeah. You know, I preserve what it is that I've got left in my knees and so on. But I do still play. So things get a little bit sore, but I'm very fortunate I can still do. Yeah. You know, the generation before me, Tim, they have, you know, here in the NSL, they had such poor resources around them. You know, you're talking a lot of hip replacements, knee replacements. You know, good friends of mine, you know, they can barely walk, let alone even think about playing in their 50s. So mm. I've been very fortunate.
Yeah. Do you still have that same tenacity on the field that you did back then, or do you take it easy?
No, actually. Well, it's funny, once you're out of the no, and then you can kind of, you know, I can decide how it is I want to play, yep. whereas often in professional environments, I had to give what was needed for the team, mm. you know. And so now, no, I can just waltz around, make no tackles, you know, and just have a little prima donna and, you know, touch the ball three times. And, you know, it gets
best
stuck in
ground.
Everyone for not playing to my feet. So yeah. It's beautiful, yeah.
Happy days. You should have done this from the get-go.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. All right, we need to take another break, Craig. After that, your transition from player to commentator and analyst, sitting alongside, as I mentioned, two absolute legends of the game here in Australia in Johnny Warren and Les Murray. We'll get into that right after we take a break. This is Inspiring Stories. Back with more in a minute.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bower and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bower and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. We are hearing the story of Craig Foster, soccer superstar, commentary superstar, and still going today. He's currently working with the Stan Sports streaming service, covering the game that he loves. But let's go back to where the commentary at least started, really started. That is part of the SBS team, the beloved SBS team, featuring Johnny Warren and Les Murray. I mean, what a gift that is to be sitting alongside, you know, two absolute champions, like those two guys. I mean, you must just pinch yourself still, knowing that you got to spend so long with these guys.
Yeah, it was incredible. You know, sport does give you those opportunities. Mm. You know, I guess you've got to be, you know, Les and Johnny were around the Socceroos a lot and so on. So, you know, by that time, you know, I knew them. I certainly knew Johnny well. And the 2002 World Cup was in Japan, Korea. I hadn't quite retired, but my body was pretty much done by then. And that Japan, Korea, of course, is in our localized time zone, and was pretty important. And they were given a bunch of games, basically. to do at short notice, and they needed another team member. And so Les called me and said, can you come over? So they were really amazing. They were loved rightly for a number of reasons, but, you know, Les represented more than the game. He represented multiculturalism. He represented, it was just that he brought it all to life through his love of football, but he represented someone from abroad who'd come to Australia with immense pride in where he'd been and who he was, you know, and he brought that out on the multicultural channel, which was amazing, really phenomenal initiative in my view, to have a multicultural broadcaster in Australia, you know, at that time in early 80s was just fantastic. And so all of a sudden you had, whether it was Lee Lin Chin or you had, you know, Les Murray, and, you know, you had these people from non-Anglo backgrounds who were able to go on air and bring their accent and bring their culture and bring their bearing to the Australian public. And what Les did, he did it, and so did the others, but in a way that it was clear he was so incredibly proud of who he was, you know, in his in everything he was. That meant, you know, coming from Hungary, right? So his language and his food, and he brought his love of football with him. And that really touched me. I thought, you know, that's really what Australia is about. And so I found a home, you know. Football was a home for many reasons. SBS became a home because I believed in that. I still do. You know, and Johnny was a bit different. He was an evangelist for the game. And he, like I, believed that football is actually good for Australia. Because, you know, he'd lived through, in a way that I hadn't, only as a player, but for decades before, Johnny had lived through all of the ethnic communities in Australia finding their place in their new country through football. So Johnny knew better, and he'd been a part of that, and he'd been the captain, you know, of this, of the Socceroos, you know, with many, with players from all around the world, whether it was British heritage or German or others. So he knew inherently better than anyone the what football offered to this relatively young immigration nation, not a young nation, but in terms of immigration. And he understood, you know, the power of the game, not just to Australia itself, not to me and you, but to actually to this concept of inclusion. And I believed in that. You know, I still very much do. So it was wonderful to work with them and to get to understand the nature of the mission that they felt they were on.
I'm sure you've got a million special memories of your time on the couch there with them. But, I mean, you know, sometimes it was 3-4 in the morning. You were doing back-to-back games. You know, we're all back at home in Australia watching bleary-eyed, sleep-deprived, and just a little bit delirious. You must have had some funny times just trying to get through those those moments with those guys.
Look, off-air was, you know, it was incredibly fun, sometimes more fun than on-air, because on-air you've got some structure. Off-air, it's just a mess. And the one thing that united us all, we were all different backgrounds, we were different ages, we were different cultures. You know, we just, that was the beauty. I mean, later on, you know, for many years, I became very close friends with Les, and I would always say, this is actually the beauty of sport. You know, all sports, but in our game, football, is a Hungarian refugee, you know, in his 60s, you know, and an Anglo kid whose family's off the, you know, the First Fleet, you know, and from a country area, sitting there as greatest friends in the world, connecting through our shared love of sport. It's, it's extraordinary connecting force. But they used to just, you know, at SBS, as soon as the camera was off, oh, you wouldn't want to have a microphone on. I mean, the carry on, you know, because we used to get stuck in, you know, because we're fans as well. So, you know, everyone would be swearing at the screen and carrying on, you know, no way, blah, 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 blah. And then, of course, it'd be, oh, God, you better get back on the stage. And we'd sit down, everyone would be very calm. Oh, well, look, you know, what the coach did here or what the player did here. But people would come there and just be surprised. They'd go, what the hell is all hell's broken loose when the whistle goes?
I suppose that's become sort of one of the things that you have been known for in the the media box or the commentary box, whatever you want to call it, Fozzie, not just your great knowledge of the game and your ability to almost forensically analyse it, but also carrying the emotion of it as well. And, you know, sometimes you've made headlines for having some very forthright interviews and things to say about, you know, people like Ange Postecoglou, it's probably the most famous one, but also Pim Verbeek as well. In happier times, though, let's just revisit 2005, Australia v Uruguay, qualifying for the World Cup. This was you in the commentary box, losing your mind.
It's 4-2.
He wins it for us. John.
Here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup.
He wins it for us.
He scores! Australia have got it!
Yeah, well, you're right. I was lost. Yeah. I was totally lost.
John Aloisi, the Confederations Cup hero, has got it.
Johnny Wayne!
At last! At long, long last! 31 years, 4 months and 24 days have passed since Australia ended its campaign.
I think you'd lost the power of speech by then, Fuzzy, but...
Yeah, I was gone, yeah.
The emotion was, was hard to contain.
Too much. And of course, what people don't see behind the scenes is all the crew, you know, the camera people and the technicians, they're all great football fans, you know, and they're Greek Australians, Italian Australians, South American Australians, you know, we had Mexicans and we had Argentines and Chileans, you know, all my friends. They're all there with us, and everyone except Simon, because, you know, Simon, you know, hadn't been too long in the country, so he was able to be, you know, really independent, which was, thank God for that, or we just would have turned off the mic.
Yeah.
But everyone else was actually in tears. Like, we were actually, I was in the back of the booth, like, virtually crying. And then that's why when he said, oh, this is happening, I said, are you sure? I just absolutely had no clue. And I'm the first person to say that's so unprofessional. Like, it's just absolutely ridiculous. It's
pathetic. It was so real.
But it was so real. And also, you know, I'd played in that team, that actual team, only a few years before. So, you know, with many of those players. So, and I knew what it meant for the game.
I
just completely lost everything, right? But you know what? In the end, that's what sport is about.
Yeah, absolutely. The passion was there on show, and you know, as we talked about, that weight of expectation, that was the release valve, wasn't it? In 2005, it was incredible.
There was so much there. There was so much. I mean, they're spending big money for Hiddink. He wasn't going to hang around wrong. You know, if we didn't get through then, you know, some of those players were retiring. We didn't know whether we were going to make it the next time. You know, the finances of the game were contingent on it. You know, they still were coming up with the professional leagues, you know, were under construction at the time, and therefore we knew what that could deliver. So that they ended up after that with that, I think, the Fox Sports contract for, you know, whatever it was, might have been over a certain number of years, I don't know, 100 and something million. So, you know, that game was worth over $100 million.
Yeah, phenomenal.
Australian football. That's what it's about. It was extraordinary. Yep. Yeah.
Outside of the commentary box, you're also taking on some very active roles in an advocacy capacity for the, you know, the players' associations and other bodies like that. And I suppose we can trace the you know, the origins of that, wanting to advocate for others back to your much younger days. How much of your time did that take up, and what did that give you? What sort of satisfaction did that give you doing those sorts of roles as well?
I just think that it's necessary. I don't know about satisfaction. I mean, some of them, because many of these issues don't come to a conclusion. So they're incredibly frustrating. They're emotional. They're horrible. I mean, look what happened with Afghanistan recently. You know, we were able to get, you know, a bunch of female athletes out of there, but there's at least, you know, 150 people still that I'm in touch with every day.
Yeah.
You know, they're just desperate to get out.
Still stuck there.
Still stuck there. And so refugee rights, you know, people in turn, you know, still imprisoned after 9 years, you know, who I know, they become friends of mine.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just horrible. So it's a real challenge. I just think that, you know, I always had this sense of wanting to contribute anyway. Even if I hadn't played for Australia, it wouldn't have mattered to me. I would have at least wanted to try and, in the least sanctimonious manner possible, to try and just make things better for others. Whatever I was able to do, it doesn't matter. I still had a very privileged upbringing. I have parents. I have two parents. I have children. You know, we had no great traumas in our life. We didn't have to flee. No one was going to torture us. So I just think that we all have to speak up. And if you know, the more of us do at the moment, there's a high unit cost for people who speak out on human rights. Doesn't matter if you want to speak out on the Uyghurs in China, or you want to speak out on Israel-Palestine, or you want to speak out on any human rights issue around the world, in Afghanistan at the moment, or, you know, Julian Assange, whatever. You know, for people who are speaking out on those, there's a high cost because there's so few.
Yep.
I happen to believe that the only way to really change the world, and we need change, you know, I mean, the place is on fire. You know, we've got an ocean full of plastic, whatever it is that moves you. If you're quite, and let's talk about racism. Okay. So, you know, if you don't speak up, if I don't say something when you know, about racism that Indigenous Australia has faced for over 200 years, well, who the hell is going to speak up? Mm. And if I then have a platform and, you know, and something where at least one person trusts me or at least is going to listen, then I have an even greater responsibility because I have privilege. Now, the more people that do it in sport, the easier it is for each of those people.
Mm.
And therefore, I'm perfectly prepared to take whatever cost that comes with that. And there are costs, you know, both personal as well as, you know, in your broader career and things, because I just happen to think that it is very, very important. And I'm in a privileged position to be able to do so.
Yeah. You've led us beautifully to this extraordinary story of Hakeem Al-Arabi, the man that you helped rescue from languishing, firstly in a prison in Thailand, and ultimately would have been in a prison or incarcerated in some way in his native country of Bahrain. But we'll get into that right after we take a break. Just in terms of your other sort of individual things that you've done, more in a player and commentator capacity, Foz, before we go to a break, you were asked to be a judge for the Ballon d'Or in 2007, which is, you know, for those who don't know, the absolute highest award you can give to an individual football player. How did that come about? And can you tell us who you voted for? Kaká won that year, 2007. Did you vote for him?
I would have definitely voted for him. I loved him. Yeah, loved him.
Phenomenal player.
I can't remember the votes. Yeah, I did it for a number of years, and then recently, you know, the system changed a bit. FIFA took it over as well, so I don't do it today. But yeah, I enjoyed that each year, trying to work out who was the best. It hasn't been too hard in the last decade, though.
No. I mean, you know, one or the other, really, isn't it?
You don't really need the judges. So I think that's why they stopped.
just put an Instagram poll out there or something.
Yeah,
these days, yeah. But like, what, worth noting that Kaká beat Ronaldo and Messi in that year of 2007 as well. But hey, he stood comfortably ahead of them.
See, they won the Champions League. Yeah, that was Spider Kalac. That was Zelka Kalac who was in that team. They won the Champions League in the repeat fixture of the Miracle of Istanbul, where Liverpool played AC Milan. And that Milan team, Seydorf, Pirlo, Kaká, Costa Curta, Maldini, Inzaghi. I mean, that thing was just, it was a machine of beauty, right? And Kaká was just an absolute magician. So he's
well deserved. All right, let's take a break. After that, we'll get you to give us at least the shortish version of Hakeem Al-Arabi, because it is an incredible story. We need to take a break. This is Inspiring Stories. Craig Foster is our special guest. Back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.
This is Inspiring Stories. Tim McMillan is my name. My special guest is Craig Foster. Craig, I've mentioned you've accomplished many things over the years. Human rights activist is just about at the top of that list now, I would dare say. Certainly, it's been a big part of your life in recent years. Hakeem Al-Arabi, it's an incredible story. Can you just give us a little short history of who Hakeem is and how he came to be on your radar?
He was a young footballer in Bahrain. He was in the under-23 national team, and he was part of a peaceful pro-democracy demonstration back around 11-12. People will remember it as called the Arab Spring, where this democracy movement was springing up across various parts of the Middle East. And because of that, the regime there, the royal family, run both the government and in positions of power. They went on television and showed some footage and said all of these high-profile people, especially sports people who took part in that demonstration against us, basically against the royal family, for a new democracy. We're an island, you can't escape, and we're going to get you, basically is what the prince said. Hakim was one of that. They rounded him up, over 150 athletes. They put them in prison and they tortured them. Mm. Because he was a footballer, they would whack him on the legs with a metal pipe. And when the blood was gone, he could take no more. They'd let him stand up and walk around, get blood back in the legs. And when they felt he could go, they'd sit him down. And this went on for months. He eventually got out, and for various reasons, he fled, escaped, he ended up in Australia. He sought asylum and was granted it. So mm-hmm. he was on a protection visa as a recognised refugee at the time when he spoke out against this regime, actually, because one of the cousins of the royal family wanted to run for the FIFA presidency against Infantino. And Hakim very bravely was here in Australia as still in his early 20s, and he came out and said, well, no, this person can't do that. He was the president of the Football Federation when our captain and me and others were imprisoned, tortured, and he said and did nothing. That individual today is the president of the Asian Football Confederation mm. and the vice president of FIFA. Nevertheless, yeah. he came out and did that. At that point, they said, all right, this guy's a dissident in another part of the world. We're going to keep an eye on him. And he decided to go to Thailand on his honeymoon. He was arrested on the tarmac in the plane when he arrived because Bahrain were tipped off that he would be coming. And a red notice was placed on him from Interpol. From that point on, it was a question of whether he'd be extradited back to Bahrain and very likely never seen again, or whether he could somehow find his way out.
Yeah. And how did you come to be aware of his predicament? When did you first learn of him and what was happening with him?
Various people got in touch. Some friends are in the football community. The PFA, yep. Of which I'm a former chair, our Players Association, got in touch because their club, Pasco Vale, his club in Melbourne that he was playing for at the time, which was in, I think, the NPL, the highest state level, all of a sudden this kid was leaving, their player was leaving, went on his honeymoon, got arrested. They found out it's all over the press because he was sharing some photos and video. And next thing, and they're saying, well, what do we do? Like, this is our player. This is an Australian, just a sports club. And they're saying, what the hell is going on? This, you know, our kid is part of our family, is in extreme trouble. What are we going to do? So they called the PFA, the Professional Footballers Australia, the Players Union, and they called me. And I said, oh, I don't know anything about this. It was probably a couple of days in. I hadn't seen it. I had other things to do. And all of a sudden I said, well, I better have a look at it. So I started to read about it. I read what was going on, thought, oh, wow, this kid's in serious trouble. I'd been involved as an executive member of our players' union. I was the CEO, I was the chair. So, in other words, I've spent 30 years advocating for players with governing bodies and often against governing bodies. So at that point, Football Australia, Asian Football Confederation and FIFA were supposed to help him.
Yep.
And after three quarters of a life, in that field, I was very sure that that was not going to happen. So I knew that he needed help.
Yeah. It would have just taken an extraordinary amount of effort and determination and time and all sorts of things on your part. Did you have to pretty much just put everything else to one side? I mean, how did you manage to maintain some sort of normality in your life? You know, tell us about the pressures on your family too to have you go off and take up this fight.
Well, it's, often the pressures on the family, my wife, Lara, and kids is discounted, including during that period by me, because I'm so focused on, the severe trauma that this kid's going through. And he's obviously a torture survivor already. It's very rough on everyone around you because you just kind of just drop everything. Yeah.
Yep.
The world ceases to exist. The same thing happened with Afghanistan recently. You know, the evacuation flights were going, the Australian flights, there's only a week before that was coming to an end. You know, there's a lot of women in trouble. They need to get on those flights. And you just shut down. The whole world shuts down and you just get so focused on, and you just go 24 hours a day, literally on adrenaline. You stop eating because your body doesn't have an appetite. You're just putting all your energy into this issue and the emotional, not strain, because the strain is on Hakim and the strain is on those women. But the emotional kind of challenge, I guess, you know, is something entirely new. It's like you just step into a completely new paradigm, a different field, and you're uncertain. Are you going to get these people killed? You know, are these women going to get on this flight? Is Hakeem going to actually get out, or am I going to mess this up completely? I've never done this before. You know, I could kill this kid. There's a whole, and you have to rationalize that in your own mind. So it's very, very tense, very intense time. And that 70 days.
Yeah.
So probably over 70 days, 75 days I was involved. It was like years, you know, you just, and so afterwards you're just like a zombie. And you're, and I know, you know, it's happened a number of times now in these campaigns, but you know, I see the signs from my wife and she sees the opposite direction, but they just can't get through to you. You don't talk to your children. You sit at the dinner table and you can't think about anything. You're just thinking, I've got this and this person's here and is the government going to help? What's going to happen? I should have spoke to that person. And you're getting texts all through the night. You just actually can't operate in the real world.
Yeah.
And these days my wife gets to the point where she says, okay, I understand what it is that you're needing to do. You're going to switch off here and we all support it because you need to get these, you know, whatever it is, these people in Afghanistan. And we just have to kind of work with that because we all believe that it's important.
Yeah.
It's a very, very intense time. The worry with Hakeem was about, I say losing because it was a battle. It was a battle against Thailand and Bahrain and also to move the Australian government. But
which took some shifting, didn't it?
They took a lot of shifting here because we had to get the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, going. Maurice Payne, the Foreign Minister, you know, I've worked with a number of times, including on Afghanistan now, is a wonderful person. But, you know, ministers can only do what the government, you know, the broader cabinet and the Prime Minister is willing to do. And, you know, Australia doesn't have a great record on refugees. In fact, I should say we have a horrible record on refugees. So this kid was a refugee, which is another reason why I knew he needed help, because I was already a refugee advocate. I thought, God, this kid's in a lot of trouble. Mm. So we had to get the government to move. So, it was, in the end, I was a lot of people kind of got in touch, and I could see people on social media working and following my lead, following my instructions. So yep. I ended up with this group of people I'd never met, about 10 people or so on social media, where we would correspond every day on direct message. I would give them the messages. So, for example, I could advocate, you know, softly with the Australian government, but I could have other people advocating at the same time on different messages very strongly.
And opening
space for me and other and the diplomats to do their work. So it was very, I worked with the embassy and the ambassador in Thailand. And thankfully, in the end, we were able to create such a noise that the Australian government, you know, decided, and Maurice was able to make her influence felt. And in the end, Scott Morrison called me when I was outside of the prison in Bangkok and said, because I shared a photo, and he said, I know you're going in to see Hakeem, please give him my best, and da da da. And that's the moment I thought, okay, we're a chance here.
Yeah, and you were a chance. I'll ask you about that moment when you found out that he was coming out. But just before we do that, let's have a listen to a piece of audio. This is you and Hakeem just returning home to Australia and facing the media for the first time, because, you know, I'm sure as people remember, it did become a massive story. And just, you know, the culmination of, as you said, over 70 days of just absolute hard work and effort. This is you talking to the media upon your return.
We were really concerned that anything we said or did could be counterproductive to seeing what we've seen today, which is a young Australian...
Good on you, Fozzie!
A young Australian reunited with his wife. I'm very proud of Australia. I'm very proud today to be Australian. I think what's occurred over the last almost 3 months to fight incredibly hard for not just a young player who virtually no one knew, but a refugee who was under our protection and who we felt that all of us needed to step forward and protect. To see him back here on home soil today speaks volumes about the character, the values, and the pride that we have as Australians.
There you go. It gives me goosebumps. Listen to that, Foz. What does it do to you?
It's good memories. I would have liked to have been more articulate, but, you know, the emotion in the
moment. Oh, exactly. The emotion got again was there on show, yeah.
Yeah, it's really severe. I already knew at that point, of course, that, you know, we have a much greater job to do in broader refugee policy, and that there was, you know, thousands of others who are, you know, deeply traumatized, including offshore and so on. So I had that in mind also during. And so I already, that morning, actually, I wrote a piece in the Sydney Morning Herald saying, look, this is great. Wonderful, you know, because there was, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of Australians who supported and many high profile people, and just said, look, this is absolutely wonderful, but this is just one kid, and there's all these other people over here that we have been harming. So, you know, we can be, you can be proud of what you all did, but please now have a look over here and let's also do the same for these people. And what is the difference? There's no difference between them. So, you know, let's be consistent.
Yeah. You mentioned in that clip there, Hakeem's wife, reuniting with his wife. I understand during the fight, she reached out to you at one point and pretty much said, please, can you save my husband? And that was an incredibly powerful moment for you personally.
Yeah, she was, she is extremely smart, very strong woman, and She came up to Sydney and we got in a room. It was reasonably early on, and, you know, I was advocating strongly, and she asked me, are you going to help my husband? And of course I said to her, yes, of course. Look, as you can see, I'm doing 1, 2, and 3, but she wasn't accepting that as an answer. In other words, she was smart enough to know that there's advocacy and there's advocacy, right? You know, we can sign a petition and do something and raise your voice. That's fine. But are you really going to go all the way for my husband, is basically what she was saying.
Yeah.
And I said to her, yes, I am. And I took her to see actually Amnesty in Sydney, and she convinced them, or helped us convince them, to come on board. And it's at that point when I started to think about planning a trip to Bangkok. And that's when, you know, we just went full on.
Yeah. Tell me about the moment that you got the news that he would be released, and also the moment where you first got to actually embrace this guy whose cause you had taken on despite never actually having met him.
I had a call from Maurice, the foreign minister, and the ambassador in Bangkok, and we knew that over about the next 72-hour period, there was negotiations going on between all of the countries about how it might be resolved. And that's because of the pressure that had been brought to bear. And they said, look, we think that, you know, the next 3 days, you know, could be solved. And then on the second day, I think it was a Saturday, I was there and I got a call from Maurice, and basically saying, look, you know, we think, it hasn't happened yet, but we think that he's going to be out tonight. Wow. And so we talked then about the way that we would handle it, what public messaging that we would, what we would talk about, because ultimately the governments needed to collaborate. And some of them, of course, were under extreme pressure and duress to do so. And so, you know, were sensitive in some respects. So, you know, we were careful in our commentary when that happened. But she said it was basically that night. And so I sat there watching Twitter and some of the journos who I knew in Bangkok, who'd come to know during, and just watching for any news. Couldn't really say anything. The only people who literally knew were just, you know, Maurice's office, the embassy, and our little family here. And then I started to see, and I got a DM from one of the key, I think, BBC journalists in Bangkok. I'm hearing this has happened, and I'm hearing something. And we knew that it was happening.
Yep.
He got out, he got put in a car, he got taken, and then it took several hours for him to get off the ground. So there was no resting until it was, as they said, wheels up. As soon as we knew he was in the air, then it was just basically a relief. You would think that it was kind of celebration. There was no celebration. It was just kind of, wow.
Yep.
You know, everyone just really collapsed. And then we got a flight late that night, almost at midnight, down to Melbourne, and we went in behind, you know, in through security into a special area to, you know, with the thanks of DFAT, to greet him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he just walked in his club shirt, you know, from Pascoe Vale, and he you know, everyone basically started crying.
Yeah.
And
what did you say to him? Do you remember? What did he say to you?
I can't remember. I think I just said, look, welcome, brother, you know, welcome home. He wasn't Australian by that time.
Yeah.
You know, I had said to him, I believe that we're going to get you out. And when you do, you know, you'll end up being Australian and you're going to contribute something great to the country. He's very thankful, you know, about what Australians have done for him. And I said, well, you know, one day you'll be very special within Australia. You also come from the Australian Muslim community, which is a really important community here, who've often felt victimized. I think you can be a voice for that. You know, what's happened to you can be a bit of a connecting force. And so you don't know where you're going to go. I think you're going to have a really powerful life and you'll be Australian. So he was just, you know, he was tired and, you know, we just hugged and we put him in, you know, he came outside, he made some comments about how thankful he was to all Australians. And then we put him in a car and he went straight to see his wife.
Yep. I bet. And you guys, are you still mates? I mean, it's an incredible bond, incredible thing to share. Are you still close and in contact?
Yeah. I call him my little brother. But he, you know, last year I shared Ramadan with him where I fasted throughout just in solidarity with him and, you know, his Muslim Australian community to kind of build a bridge between there because there's still a lot of, racism, but also still a lot of uncertainty and misunderstanding. And, you know, so sometimes these things can be utilized in a positive sense as well to create, you know, better understanding of Hakim's community and Hakim's beliefs and others and his community in Australia. They had a baby boy almost a year ago now. And, you know, they moved on into a new house. And so they're rebuilding their life. And there is a lot of rebuilding happening.
I bet.
Because, you know, he'd had a traumatic number of years as a refugee fleeing and all of these things. So we're in touch constantly and he's doing well.
Yeah, good to hear. And just lastly, Craig, what's next for you? Are you the sort of person that has a bucket list or what do you see, you know, sort of demanding most of your life force going on from here?
Yeah, I don't really 100% know at the moment. The way I kind of handle it is I just do things that I'm passionate about and I feel like I'm going to be able to look back and say, yeah, that was something good. I spent my time here in a way that I'm proud of and that I might have been able to contribute to something and not just sport. You know, sport is not enough. Perhaps through sport, through football, for example, we can do much greater things socially. So that's one of the big focuses at the moment is how can football and broader sports step up on some of these broader social change issues, climate change and other things. That's a big focus now. And I'll see what happens in future. Just trying to make a positive impact in as many ways as I possibly can.
Yep. Well, we know that whatever you do, you'll do it with all the heart and tenacity that we've come to see from you over so many years, wearing so many different hats. So congratulations on everything that you've achieved, and we look forward to your many adventures to come. Thank you so much for sharing your inspiring story with us on the program. We do appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good to chat.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to Inspiring Stories here on 882 6BR. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. We look forward to you joining us again next time as we unearth another inspiring story.